I would like to introduce the first speaker, Adrian S. from the We Do Recover group of Narcotics Anonymous from the Northeast area of NA.
I'm Adrian, I'm an addict. My clean date is January 12, 2011. I just got asked like 2 days ago to share on this topic. That's probably for the best, because like when I'm asked to share and I have a lot of time before I have to share, I get all up in my head, and I share in the shower and in front of the mirror and when I'm laying in bed at night, and I come up with all these really profound things I'm going to say, and none of them ever come out. So I'm glad I really didn't have time to think about this. So anyway, so my step is 4 and 5. I just want to read something out of It Works, How and Why. The solution to our problem is a profound change in our thinking and our behavior. We need to change how we perceive the world and alter our role in it. We need to change our attitude. You know, I didn't realize until I did this step that that was the root of my problem. My perception my whole life was just so distorted. I thought that every rule was made to be broken, and it was my goal in life to see how much I could break them without getting caught or without getting arrested. Now, I know now that that is truly not possible. But it started even as a young child. I had to control everything, and I think it might have had to do with a lot of the sexual abuse I suffered as a child by my stepdad. So I developed these control issues. And like in the third grade, all the kids in my neighborhood had to play at my house. And I was one of those kids that they would say, well, you know, we want to play this or we're going home. And I'd say, well, take your ball then and go home. Like I was totally, totally okay with that. And I met up with a couple other friends that were just like me. And we decided we were going to start holding this carnival in my yard every summer. And we were going to charge all the kids in the neighborhood $2 a piece to come and play in my yard. And I truly didn't see anything wrong with that. And neither did the other kids. They came and played in my yard because, like, that was the spot to be. I don't know why. I don't know what there was to offer there, because I was mean. I was truly mean to my friends. It had to be my way or the highway. And we started this little club. It was called the Witches Club. And now that I'm older and I know it was really the Snitches Club, I would make all the kids in the neighborhood say a swear word. And I would write your name down and write the swear word that you said, and we'd hide it in this little lockbox. And then if you would want to tattle on one of us, we'd say, well, before you tattle, remember, you swore that one day, and we're going to show your mom this paper. It backfired. It really didn't work. I'm the one that ended up getting in trouble for making all these kids swear. But I truly thought that, like, I was the goody-goody little kid. I never thought I was that bad kid. You know, that our parents always tell us, don't hang out with the wrong crowd. I was that wrong crowd. And I really never knew that. And I was totally attracted to people that were just like me. I grew up in New Kensington in a real small school. There was only like 5 kids in each class. But even though I had to be the boss and control everything, I really felt inadequate. I had real low self-esteem. I wasn't good at any sport ever because I have terrible eyes. I like to blame it on that. Like, I wasn't in any clubs. I wasn't the smartest kid. I wasn't the dumbest kid. You know, I was this average kid. But I didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. So I moved to Plum when I was about 13. And that summer, I discovered sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I ruled with that motto for like years and years and years to the extreme. Since I wasn't good at anything else, I was good at getting high. So I thought, like, I finally had found my niche. I had a group of people that I could do it with. They laughed. They didn't really laugh at me. They didn't laugh with me. They laughed at me. But, you know, that was really okay for the time being. You know, my disease progressed, and I just, you know, I got off the chain. So I think as a result of the sexual abuse I suffered as a child, possibly could be why I really ruled with that sex part. Like, I became the neighborhood slut. And I wasn't okay with it, but that was the only way I knew how to, I guess, how to make friends or how to fit in or something. And I always regretted it the next day or the next morning, but I still kept doing it. And I like to think that when I was younger that I dressed nice because I cared about my appearance. That really isn't true. I like to dress like a slut. I wanted to look as good as I could so I could get as many men as I could. I never wanted my own man. I wanted your man and your man and your man, because my drugs was my primary love in life. So I wanted that man that at the end of the night, I could be like, well, go home to your wife because I got to get high. But in my mind, I thought I was being independent and I didn't need anybody and I was being self-sufficient. And a predecessor of mine always tells me that in the readings, it tells us that self-sufficiency is a lie. That's why this is a we program. somehow I made it through high school. I made it through college. I really don't know how that happened. Thank God I had a grandfather in my life that instilled early in my life that education is something that can never be taken away from me. So as I was growing up, it was never a question of what are you going to do when you graduate high school. The question was, what college are you going to? If I would bring home a bad grade, I was grounded, it seems like, forever. So I did really well in school, and I thought I was real fortunate for that, but I think it was a drawback because that helped me develop my motto of I want to put in the least amount of effort and get the maximum outcome. I didn't have to put any effort in school, and I could get good grades. So then I started with, well, then I really shouldn't even have to go to school, and I rarely went to school. So, of course, there was this, you know, state law that you could only miss so many days of school without an excuse, and you couldn't graduate. So, with my addict behaviors, I had went to a printer and got a notepad printed up with my mother's signature on the bottom of it, and then I would keep it in my locker, and every day I would just, you know, write an excuse for myself with my mom's signature. Well, lo and behold, my homeroom teacher never turned it into the principal, and at the end of the year, they said I had missed 54 days of school and I couldn't graduate. And I was just appalled. I said, why does it matter how many days I missed? I got straight A's. I should be allowed to graduate. Like, aren't I your model student? And by all means, I was not a model student, but I got good grades. So in my mind, I should be given the same opportunities as kids that are putting in hard work without having to do anything. And that, you know, that just didn't happen. So my parents made me spend all the money I'd got for my graduation to get a lawyer to be able to graduate high school. And I just, you know, I thought that was ridiculous. I shouldn't have to do anything like that because I'm special. The Onions know I'm special. I get good grades. And I thought I was so responsible. And I was the most irresponsible kid in the world. You know, even on days I would go to school, I couldn't get out of bed. My parents literally had to drag me out of bed and throw me in a cold shower to get me to go to school. I didn't want to do anything I was supposed to do. I wanted to buck the system the whole way. So, even, you know, my forging and my rule breaking, you know, it started real early. As I got older, I decided when I first went to college, I was going to the School of Pharmacy down at Pitt. Thank God they threw me out. I'd be dead or in federal prison by now. But at the time, you know, I couldn't see that I wasn't going to class. Like, you know, in college, it's the you miss 3 days, you're failing. And I couldn't since I had all these old behaviors I'd carried from high school with me, I felt that, well, if I got good grades, why are you throwing me out? Well, because the rule is you can only miss 3 days. And I had a big resentment against the whole University of Pittsburgh for a real long time. And so I ended up finally graduating from college. I was on, like, that decade plan. And I got a good job doing accounting, and they were only paying me so much money per hour, and I thought that was appalling because, you know, they're a Fortune 500 company. I should be getting paid more. So I didn't think it was a problem because I wasn't breaking into someone's house and stealing, so I would steal from work. I would steal everything I could get my hands on. Like, I literally had cases of Post-it notes in my house. Cases of paper clips. Like, what? There's still some floating around till this day, and that was 20 years ago I worked at this place. So, but I never really had gotten in trouble or suffered any consequences where I thought these behaviors were wrong. Until one time, our company was moving to Ontario, and they were nice enough to tell me I could have all the office equipment and office furniture. It would cost too much money for them to move it all. And I'm like, hey, they're giving me something. This is cool. So I go in and take it, and I also decided that I needed their postage. Now, they didn't tell me I could have their postage. Of course, the Pitney Bowes postage machine was supposed to get returned. So I printed out all this postage, and of course, since our contract had ended, it all expired, like, at the end of the month. But I insisted on stealing $500 worth of postage that I didn't need. Well, the postal inspector comes to my house, and it was the first time in my life I had had that sick to my stomach, I'm going to jail feeling. Like, I finally had got caught, and I didn't know how to get out of it, and it's by the postal inspector. And so, you know, my husband's telling me, you're going to federal prison, like, over some postage. And I just, you know, I didn't know what to do. And somehow I got out of it. I don't have any idea how I got out of it. I guess the company probably ended up moving to Ontario and forgot about it. So that also just reinforced my bad behavior, thinking that I can get away with everything. So then I got real big into forging loans and forging documents. And I'd taken out a mortgage or a home equity line of credit for $100,000. And I didn't even have a job. And when the lady from the bank said that you need to make $28 an hour to secure a $100,000 line of credit, there was a reason. Because if you don't make $28 an hour, Adrian, you're not going to be able to pay this loan back. But I couldn't fathom that. So I had all this money, and my whole life since I'd started getting high, the way that I got high was by selling drugs. And I really thought I was good at that. I had a degree in business. But even as a young kid, I sold weed when I smoked weed. You sold coke when I did coke. By the end, I sold everything because I did everything. But I actually had a very lucrative drug operation for about 25 years. And so I didn't see drugs as a problem because I was always getting high on other people's money. So even though about 10 years before I got clean, it had started getting really, really bad. We had lost 3 houses and 5 cars in the matter of a year. I'd had all this money with selling drugs, but we got sick in the house we had lived in. It had a mold problem. And it was the first time in my life that I was jobless, homeless, penniless, no material possessions. And to make it all worse, I was hopeless and helpless. And I didn't know what to do with myself. My whole life, my identity was based on my college degree and my title at the job that I had, because I had no spiritual principles, no values. I didn't know who I was. So once I lost all that stuff, I just really didn't know what to do. I didn't know what humility meant, so I didn't know how to ask for help. I was so caught up in my addiction that I would call some lawyers to help me out with these problems, but I couldn't make the appointment. Then my addiction got so bad, I couldn't even call to make an appointment. I didn't even bother calling to make an appointment because I knew flat out I wasn't going. There's nothing cutting into my getting high time. All I'm going to do is get high, and that's it. So while I have no spiritual principles and I'm empty inside, and then I also have no material possessions, I figured, well, it's time to get the drug operation going again. The problem is probably I don't have enough drugs. That's what I concluded, because I would have had a lot of drugs, and I figured that would fix everything. So I started a heroin distribution operation, and I thought that was going to just fix all my problems. Well, all my problems were still there, and now I developed a whole new set of problems. Things I never thought would happen, thugs breaking into my house, having home invasions. Meanwhile, I thought I was a thug. I'm a 100-pound white girl, at the time probably an 80-pound white girl, going into the projects, having large quantities of drugs at my house. My husband's in jail, and I'm thinking I'm going to be cool. And that just was not the fact. A lot of my family members used to go to the methadone clinic every morning. I was too cool for that. I didn't want to do that. I was going to do it my way. But I used to think that they were pieces of shit because they didn't leave their kids home with me. I said, you shouldn't take your kid to the methadone clinic. You should probably leave your kid at the shooting gallery, and they'll be safer here. And I had a resentment against these people for a long time for not letting me watch their kids. Thank God, they didn't let me watch their kids. During the time this was all going on, I was also raising my nephew. I guess our disease is sick in all of us. My sister and her boyfriend are addicts also, and they thought it was a good idea too that I raised them. Even though we're all addicts, we come up with the conclusion that since I get my drugs delivered to me and I don't have to go out and get them, he'd be better off staying with me than having to live with them and go on 15 crack runs a day. And in all of our minds, we thought that was just the greatest thing in the world. But meanwhile, I had no utilities. There's this newborn, then he's up to an infant, then to a toddler living at my house. I don't know what my thinking was. My perception was so distorted. I wouldn't get utilities turned on because I was trying to prove a point to my husband. I'm not real sure what that point was. We had thousands of dollars in our pocket, but I wouldn't even let him go down and get the utilities turned on. It didn't matter at the time because I wasn't showering. If I took a shower, I'm going to miss the next phone call. I'm going to miss the dope man. There was a chance of that happening. But the 100% chance of what was going to happen is my husband was going to steal some of my shit. So, showering was out of the question, sleeping was out of the question. You know how we do, we stay up until we pass out. And one night, right after my nephew had left my house, had just left, 2 minutes after that, we had a severe home invasion. Some people came in, started firing off guns. It got real bad. And finally, the neighbors had called the cops because clearly they were sick of it. I lived in the same house for 15 years. This is going on every day. And once the gunfire started going off in the neighborhood, they called the police, and that didn't stop me. Just nothing ever stopped me. So after I got arrested, I still wouldn't stop. I'm sitting in my kitchen all by myself getting high after I get out of jail, and a cop that was kind of a friend of ours comes to the door, and he's like, Adrian, you've got to stop getting high and selling drugs. Meanwhile, my house looked like it was on hoarders. I'm by now 70 pounds, still haven't showered. And I'm like, dude, I quit. Look at me, I quit. And he's like, maybe you should move on to Trenum. And I said, no, you know, we're good. He goes, how about move out of the county? He's like, this is a county-wide task force. Like, you really need to move. And I was thinking, like, who's this dude think he is? But, I don't know, thank God the Lord intervened, and I got a program called Drug Court, and that's where I got clean. But let me tell you, I thought I was this big control freak, this big thug. I was ignorant to everybody, belittled everybody, because, you know, I was the dope man, and I had a college education, and I was using it for real good purposes, I guess, sales and distribution. And I would belittle everyone. I thought I was better than. And from that first day I went to jail, I totally quit speaking. I became a mute. My life was much better in jail than it was on the street. And then I got sent to a program. Now, mind you, I was only in jail for 21 days. That was really totally enough for me. But I get to this program, and I knew nothing. I thought I was so smart because I knew the world, and I knew nothing. I literally did not speak for weeks upon end. You know, I would maybe say, hi, I'm Adrian, I'm an addict. But I didn't know how to talk. I didn't know how to communicate. Even though I had a college degree with a minor in communications, the only thing I knew how to say was what you got or what you need. That was totally it. But from that first day clean, that realization hit me that I know nothing. But I hadn't fully bought into Narcotics Anonymous yet because I hadn't really been to too many meetings, you know, just the ones the rehab would take me to. So I didn't know anything about support and we and humility or anything like that. I thought that I was the biggest piece of shit. I thought I was the worst addict. I was inferior to all you people. I had done worse than anyone ever did. And I saw you all laughing and, like, going about your lives. And I'm thinking, like, how is this possible? If they're as big as a piece of crap as I am, you know, they should be sitting in the corner crying. And it took me till I had about 18 months clean till I could even do a reading at a podium. Now, I think that a big reason why I probably drank a lot when I was using is when I would drink, after the first couple drinks, I would become the person I thought everybody wanted me to be or that I wanted to be. I would become outgoing, talkative. But, of course, I couldn't stop at a couple drinks. I couldn't stop till all the drinks were gone, and then I was that person that I hated and everybody else hated. But through working these steps and finding out that I do love myself, I don't need those drinks anymore to become that person. That quiet little shy Adrian has turned into be that sort of kind of loud, obnoxious Adrian. But I'm totally okay with that today. Like, that's who I want to be. I do want my voice to be heard, but I learned to get that humility. I ask things. Like, when I first come around, if I would have mispronounced a word in a reading, I would have probably had a stroke. Like, I don't know what I would have done. And now, if I'm reading something, hey, do you guys know what that means? Can someone help me out? Now, I take it to the extreme because I can't just ask one person. I have to ask every person in the room what it means and then take a vote on how many people had this one answer, and I'll go with that. But I have no problem asking questions today. It's just, it's amazing what this program has done for me. So when I did the fifth step and went over all this with my sponsor, you know, the stuff I shared here about my past and the sexual abuse and what a piece of shit I was, man, I wouldn't have told anybody that ever. And as I'm sharing it with my sponsor, and she's like, this happened to me too. Yeah, that happened to me too. It happened to my brother. It happened to this person. And I'm like, wow, like, I'm not the only one that this stuff has happened to. And look, these people are all okay, and they can talk about it. And then I learned that while I'm sharing in a meeting, maybe I can share about these subjects. And now that I'm okay and have learned to deal with these subjects and I've got through it, maybe by me sharing about it can help that next person that's too embarrassed to share that they've been through that. So after I started sharing about it in meetings for a while, then I could actually get up and say it in a lead. Like, it is so freeing, because that stuff kept me down for a long, long time. You know, all the things that I feel guilty and shameful of that happened to my addiction, it really kept me down for a long time. But just from being here and listening what everybody else says, none of us are better than the other. None of us are worse than the other. Like, I'm one of you guys just trying to get another day clean, and that's what we're all here for. So that is what I've learned from my fourth and fifth step. But thanks for allowing me to share.
I'd like to introduce the second speaker, Dennis F. from the Recovery and Survival Group of Narcotics Anonymous in the Cumberland County, New Jersey area of NA.
Good morning. My name is Dennis, and I'm an addict.
Hi,
Dennis. Boy, thank you very much, Ethan. I've identified a lot of things. Well, Fourth and fifth step. Let me start off by letting you know that Jersey is still over that way. It's back east. It's not a bad place to be. I had a lot of fun growing up in my younger days. My mother and father stayed together until my mother passed away. My father passed away on my birthday about 7 years ago. My brothers, I have three brothers and a sister, and we were a very close-knit family. I remember over the years, my father had a government job. Over the years, we used to take these nice vacations during the summer. And I didn't really understand or didn't really fully see that we were really poor to a degree. You know, we had a house. Everybody had, you know, I shared a room with my younger brother. My two older brothers shared a room. My sister had a room by herself. My parents had their own room. But we went on these vacations to New York State, Pennsylvania. We even went to Disney World in Florida. Whoa! Man, we're talking about Disney World. They only opened up a few years ago. And I'm at Disney World. I come back to school. What'd you do for your summer vacation? I went to Disney World. Had a great time. We even went to, SeaWorld. When I see an orca, he splashed me. Life was pretty good then. Went to church on Sundays. Prayer meeting on Wednesdays. Was in the choir. Was going nice and smooth. I was having a good time. Life was beautiful. Age 18, I left high school. Started my first year of college. My first day, I started smoking marijuana. First day. Mind you, all through my 8th grade, through senior high school, I thought I was a top athlete. I watched football games, I watched baseball games, I watched basketball games, and listened to what those athletes say that they were going to do, how they practice, and I would practice the same way. Just as hard. I stayed just as hard into it. Not to boast about this, but I just want to put this out there just to show you how hard I worked at that. In 1975, you are looking at the All-North Jersey High Hurdle Champion. Push myself to that level. First day of school, my first roommate, I started smoking marijuana. From that day to 6 years ago, it was all downhill. It never got any better. I had decent grades in school. I didn't get a scholarship. I got grades from band, from track. But still, something was missing. What was missing out of my life and I found out in my fourth step was the fact that I was trying to be somebody I was not. I worked so hard at trying to be somebody I was not. Because of my ability to play sports and be picked first or second, or my ability to be able to run faster than most other people because I worked hard at it, I thought I was better than everybody. I'm one step from God. They made me, broke the mold, made everybody else. You know, and I could take control. What? Come on. You know, but it wasn't true. It was a facade I presented in my own mind so that you would know that I felt an inadequacy, that I was not equal to you, that I was not as good as you. I performed like I was better than you. When I got home, it was Epsom salt, laying in the tub. Oh my God, my body's hurting. But I still kept this up to the point when I was using. I told people I was in the Marine Corps. I was in Special Forces. I spent time overseas. I did some things in the Marine Corps that you would... I never spent a minute in the Marine Corps. I never even wrote my name down to apply for the Marine Corps. My father was a Marine. He was a sergeant. One day, I'll tell you, the second worst beating I got in my life was when I went in the basement to clean it up, you know, summertime, 15 years old, 16 years old. I opened up the basement closet door, and there in front of me, the angels opened, the sky opened up, the angels came down, you could hear the music, was my father's dress blues. In plastic. Yeah, I did. I put it on. You talking about being stupid? I came up the steps. Hey, Dad! First time in my life I've ever seen a man in his 40s look at me with a death look. I said, can I wear this to the Halloween party this fall? All I heard was, go downstairs, and take that off. But Dad, go downstairs and take that off. When he says it the second time, that's the old gunfighter, Jack. You don't mess with him. You walk away clean. Okay, yep, got it. I've seen him spank my brothers, and I didn't want to get that kind of a spanking. But my father was a disciplinarian, but he loved you with it. He was always going to tell you. It wasn't mean. I never disrespected my father, hated my father for the beatings, because I knew I did something wrong. I knew I did something wrong. And same thing with my mom. Just because we were going quicker, she couldn't catch it, so off came her sneaker. She'd throw it at you like a boomerang as we ran up the steps and stuff. Crazy. But then I started to look at myself when I got into the Narcotics Anonymous program. And I started to see some things from my past. Well, yeah, my life became unmanageable. 33 years later, after using every drug they could probably make or write, I started out with marijuana, found out how to sell it, where I could get it so I could sell it. I'm still in college. My college grades started to slowly dip. I was out of school by my second semester as a sophomore. Failed one course in my freshman year and told myself I'll never fail another course because I want to be able to work any job I could possibly could. Ego. Ego. But what did that ego do? My disease said, oh, okay. We got a job for you. It's called, go sell those drugs. I'm right behind you. I'm with you. Go ahead. Let's go sell drugs. At college, you got all these people that want to buy. Go ahead. And for the first few years of selling drugs, never got caught. And I started finding out about cocaine. And I like in that movie, what's that movie with Johnny Depp, you know, Blow. I went into college trying to get an education to be an industrial arts major so I could teach other kids how to do electronics and auto mechanics, because that's what I was decently good at the time as I was going through the years. And I came out an education on how to be a drug dealer, how to sell cocaine. Problem was, my drug of choice. So I became my own best customer. Couldn't get that done. On and on and on. Every job I had after that, every issue I had after that, I hurt myself. There's so much pain and agony. And I'm just still, you know, you're just like, I'm a Marine. Huh, tough it out. No one can tell me. What? Stand up strong. Chest out. But I'm lying. Inside, I was in pain. Why, man? Why did I lose that job? I had good money at it. But I wouldn't let you see that. This mask. This facade, this ideology that I'm not that. Kept working at it. I kept using. Somewhere along the line, I never even realized until I worked out with my sponsor, but somewhere along the line, there came a realization that, could it be the drugs? Nah. I got to move out of Trenton, New Jersey. I got to move out of Newark, New Jersey. I got to move out of these heavy-duty spots. Go someplace where it's urban. Go someplace where it's cool. Guy like me, I talk nice. I don't talk like I'm a hood. I don't wear colors. You know, so what I can fit in anywhere. Here's another way of sliding in. I'm lying to myself again. Deceiving myself. Self-deception. Egotistical. Self-centeredness. Who am I to think I can control and manipulate other people through the use of selling them drugs? But I tried. In doing my fourth step with my sponsor, when we came to it, I'm so glad the steps are written the way that they're written. And the steps follow a certain set of procedures. I didn't want to admit I was an addict. My vision of an addict is the guy in Newark that's laying in the gutter with a needle in his arm. The dude that had been drinking so much he's got urine down his pants, shirt open, and he smells like horse manure. That's not me. I'm not an addict. I still got a job. I'm still going to work. It's a part-time job, or it's through an agency or something. It's not I'm not full-time yet, but I'll get there. Lying to myself again. I'm holding myself back from proceeding in my life to being something that I was meant to be. because I used drugs and everything else. I started to be happy that when I first sat down, my sponsor went over who's an addict, and at the end he said, who's an addict? I realized I am. There's certain things in that chapter. I love that chapter particularly. Especially when it talks about, let me go, I'm not going to paraphrase, I'm not good at that, so I'm going to read it right out of the book. He's an addict. Certain things follow us as we continue to use. We became accustomed to the state of mind that is common to addicts. We forgot what it was like before we started using. We forgot about our social graces. We acquired strange habits and mannerisms. We forgot how to work. We forgot how to play. We forgot how to express ourselves and how to show concern for others. We forgot how to feel. It seemed that we were at least two people instead of one. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Remember that Marine Corps thing I was talking about? We ran around trying to get our lives together before our next run. Sometimes we could do this very well, but later it was less important and more impossible. In the end, Dr. Jekyll died and Mr. Hyde took over. Mr. Hyde had been hiding in me since my early childhood and I did not know it. When I did my fourth step with my sponsor, something came out that I hadn't forgotten about until I did it. When I was younger, in my hometown, in my neighborhood I lived at, most of the people that lived around me in my neighborhood lived someplace else. They were affluent people. I'm talking about on both sides, on all sides of life. I had people who were Spanish, who were black, who were white, who were Indian. They owned homes elsewhere, but these were their summer homes. There was very few people that lived in my community that was their home year round. My next door neighbor was a super of a very high, very tall, high-rise apartment building in New York City. So he would come out here in his Cadillac. He would come out here in his Eldorado. And he would call his buddies up to come out there to, on his, you know, for the 4th of July or Memorial Day. And there would be these Cadillacs and these big cars and all parked there with all kinds of big wheels and shiny this and shiny that. And they would go in the backyard and they would open up that cooler, be mad beer in there, and they'd be smoking and talking and gambling at the kitchen table or the picnic table. I live right next door. I'm 8 years old. His grandson would come out, and him and I, I was his practice dummy, being honest, but he was in the karate. I was his practice dummy, but I learned a little bit. But what I did learn was that I could be of service. Not N.A., but I could be of service. When Mr. Johnson over there said, hey, young man, come here. I go over there. Just do me a favor. Go in that cooler over there and get me a beer. Sure, Mr. Johnson. Here's your beer. Want me to take that old beer from with me? Oh, yes, please. You're a good young man. Here's a couple of dollars for you. Take that, go over here, pour that with the other empty beer. Now I got a full can of beer.
Yeah.
How sick is that? I'm 8 years old. Didn't realize that, but when I went over with my sponsor, it came out. Okay. So when I got to college, that's just a following through from what I had when I was younger. These things come out when you do step one. These things become prevalent. They start to come out of you like I'm talking to you. They ooze through your skin. We got to write these things down. If you put it down on paper, you can't deny it no more. And then when you get with your sponsor later on and the God of your understanding, you sit down and you talk about it, to hear it from your own mouth. Now you can't deny it. You just have to work at being better at it. Not going to fall back into that same habit. Not going to fall back in that same boat. You're not going to go down that same road anymore. You do the best that you can, the best of your ability. This is how we live the steps. This is how I live the steps. I may do step 4 and 5 today, and it'll sink in, but I may not really start practicing until I get to step 7 or step 8. It may not really become prevalent when something like character defects and shortcomings really hit me in my face. But there's no way in the world someone's going to tell me it doesn't work. I love this program. It's been working for me for the last 6 years. My clean date is June 9th, 2009. And every morning I get up just for today, I thank the God of my understanding that I have an opportunity to breathe fresh air, go to my sorry job that I love to do my work at, although I don't like the company, but what I do, I love. But I'm freer than I was when I got started in this process. I'm happier than I was when I was using. There were some happy times, yeah. When I had all these drugs and I had a couple girls over here and there was booze over here. But that was about this long in my lifespan of this big. Right or wrong? I have constant scars in my body, physical scars in my body that remind me of my drug usage. But the mental scars are always going to be there. These may heal on the outside. But like I always say to my sponsees, you can't fix a problem that's working from you on the inside from the outside. Changing your clothes, taking your... Look, guys, don't get sweet on me, but I know a few guys that have wear makeup, all right? You know what I'm saying? You wear these lightening stuff for your skin or stuff to protect your acne, stuff like that there. So don't say nothing about, I've never prostituted myself. Your disease told you when to get up and go. You were being prostituted. Be real. I unmasked that by myself. No, I was never prostituted. Not me. I never wore pumps, little short skirt stockings. Of course not. But when a disease says it's time to go out and get another bag of crack, I was out there looking. Crack was my drug of choice. Before that, it was freebasing. I got to a point in my life, it was crazy. I'm living homelessly. I lived homelessly for 7 years before I got clean. This is crazy. And I was living out of abandoned cars. Okay, in this junkyard, an abandoned van, whatever, sometimes. But the owner knew that owned the property. And the guys that worked in the body shop knew that. But when the owner left to go home, the guys in the body shop used to call me to come do something for me. Hey, chef! Oh, chef! Come cook this coke up. Hey, chef! Where you at? Get your tools, baby. Come on in here. Do this for me. That was my name, Chef. You know how many times my name has changed over the years? You know, in jail, I'm this person. And then when I'm on the streets, I'm that person. But nobody even knew my name was Dennis for the longest time. Why? Because I allowed that to happen. And I let that perception be brought into your mind. I'm not Dennis. I'm Chef. When I finally got caught out there, they had raided the yard and everything like that, I had to move. So I moved. I moved from there to a charter bus that was abandoned. Before that, I had this. There was a joke that was going around. These guys were teasing me. I said, oh, man, you were living out there in that 280Z, right? Yeah. Well, where are you living in now? I'm living in a Mercedes. Oh, moving on up. There. Front. Passing the side seat of a Mercedes. It's wild, man. You know, that's classy. Mm-hmm. But I'm still homeless. I didn't care. I had to pay rent. Didn't have to pay electric. All my money went for drugs and alcohol. That was my mindset. That was my thinking. That's all I knew. That's my belief system. Why get a place to stay when I can wash up in the bathroom at the back of the restaurant I work at, and I can sleep out here in this car? Pretending to be the security person for the yard. What security? I have some hookers come in there. Hey, Dennis, yeah. When I pull in with this John, give us 15 minutes and come out with your flashlight, scare, and we get the money, you go get some for us. No problem. Prostitution again. I had to look at all this stuff. What are my body behaviors? What's going on here? What am I doing to myself? What am I doing to the people around me? During all this time period, these 33 years of using, I missed out on some very important things in my family. To this very day, my younger brother still holds it against me for not being there for his wedding. He's getting better with it. I've gotten better with it. But it still hurts. It still hurts. My using kept me out there so long, I missed that. And we were close. We were tight. You know, he looked up to me for a lot of things. You know, and that really hurts. But My older brother and I, were my family, we're starting to get close now. After I had rehab and I went to Happy Back program, I was on the street. I started taking care of things. I started looking at some things. I kept looking at myself. I'm not going to go back to using, but there's something else wrong here that I'm doing. It's my behaviors. It's that baggage that I was carrying all through the years, and I haven't gotten rid of some of the stuff that I need to get rid of. Inside that bag are some good qualities. I got to keep some of those things. And there's a lot of things I got to work on, but there's some things there that's just dragging me down, holding me back. Have to look at those things and get better with them. I never treated, well, I can't say never, but for the most part of my using, I never treated women like a woman. To me, it was an exchange deal. Okay? For sexual gratification, I will get you drugs. And people knew I could do that. That's not good. Where did that come from? How did I do that? My mother and father never treat each other poorly. Where'd that come from? What had that happen? It happened because my belief system changed. I'm getting misinformed information from misinformed people. That tore my life up. That destroyed me. But I'm getting better with that. After that situation, I did get married. I'm divorced now, but I did get married. My wife left me because of the fact she's from Africa. I have two, you know, she had two children. I adopted them. But what hurt me one day was when my son said to me at Newark Airport when I was sending them back to Africa to be with their aunt. He looked me in my face. He said, "You know, I'm glad you showed me what not to be." He just graduated high school. He knew what was going on. He wasn't a dummy. She didn't. She was younger. She was just starting eighth grade. So I didn't want him to see this because it was starting to get bad. My wife was a home health aide. She wasn't home all the time. I was home all the time. And I was just hustling. Never no straight job. I was always utilizing whatever I've learned over the years. How to paint. How to do construction. How to install a boiler. How to clean your restaurant. How to walk your dog. Cut your grass. Fix a fence. Handyman. I was pretty good at it. Made a decent living at it. But all it did was be using. Most of the money she sent home covered the rent, covered the electric. I covered the food, make sure the kids had clothes and clean clothes to go to school. You know, this little stuff. But when he said that to me, it was like a small eye-opener. Of course I went out and used behind it. It hits me here, but it just kind of washed off from home. I had no regard for any other human being anymore. I lost that. I didn't respect my own kids. I have to look at that. Where did I come from? What did I do? I allowed the disease of addiction to take over everything. I pushed all these good qualities behind me, put a mask on, and came out. When I did my fourth step, I started taking off that mask. I started fighting my way through the thickets and the bushes of all the things I put in front of those good things that I've done. There are the good qualities in me. When you do your fourth step and you look at your fourth step, there's a lot of good things that you have done. There's a lot of good things you have with you. Carry them with you. Nurture them. Keep them strong. There are a few things that you need to look at that you got to get rid of. We're all not perfect. If we were, we wouldn't be here. None of us. But we take one day at a time to look at that. One day. All we have is today. Tomorrow's not promised to us, and yesterday is a memory and a history. So all you have is today when you wake up in the morning to do something for yourself for your recovery, to go forward with your life. I had to learn also that I can't blame other people for it. Oh, the cops caught me. Man, if I had just waited 10 more minutes, they would have drove by. I could have walked out of the projects. It would have been okay. If it wasn't for her running her mouth so loud, we wouldn't have been caught up in the bushes here smoking crack. If it hadn't been for me drinking this vodka, I would have been in my right frame of mind to know that I was actually smoking candle wax and not crack. Never gonna buy that vodka again. Shame on you, vodka. I'm not gonna touch any more of that Smirnoff stuff. I'm gonna go to Lair's. I'm going to try Grey Goose. Whatever it is. It's still vodka. It's still poison. If you pour it on the crowd, it takes the pain off. What's it doing to my insides? Hey. I had one of my sponsors in my car. Recently, I haven't had my driver's license in 20 years. And a year ago, I got my driver's license and I bought a car. And like, it's been like the most amazing thing to be able to drive again. I don't know about anybody else, but it's like I'm like a new kid, you know, a little kid. My sponsor calls me, yeah. He goes, where are you at? I'm on the road. It's 11 o'clock at night. Where are you going? Around. I'm out. Are you okay? Yeah, I'm good. I'm fine. Well, turn the music down so you can talk to me, fool. Sorry about that. You know, he sees me on the road. What's wrong with this guy? You know, I have my sponsor in the car. I pick up people. I mean, like when I go to my meetings, my home group, if you call me and you need a ride, I don't care how far away you are, I'm going to come get you. Because somebody did that for me. To a certain point, they did that for me. And then I was lucky enough that my home group, when it was original, when I came out of the halfway back program I was in, I was supposed to move into a sober house, sober living home. And I only had to walk 10 blocks down the street to go to my meeting. So when I started doing that, the owner of the house, who was also part of my home group, said, why don't you take over responsibility? Responsibility? Why don't you, yeah, let me try to make the coffee. All right, fine. Okay. You like doing that? Yeah. Come by next, you know, we meet twice a week, Thursdays and Saturdays. Come by Saturday. Okay. I go by Saturday. He's there. He's sweeping out front some leaves and stuff. Go make the coffee. You know, the meeting's going to start in a little while. Oh, okay. Then he stopped coming. And I'm showing up and I'm still making the coffee. And then they give me a key. They gave me a key. It was one of the wonderful things, you know, you sit down and do it. But I, like I was saying before, I will always go out of my way to help somebody else. I just like to do it. I've had quite a few people call me. They've lost their license, lost their car. I do not mind turning my car into a bus to go pick up somebody to go to a meeting. But I'm going to get back to the main story. I had one of my sponsees in the car. And I think he called me because he was shopping somewhere. He had a lot of stuff. I went to go pick him up. And as we were driving out of the parking lot, this red Mustang goes by. So I said, I know cars very well, so you know, I'm not going to give you the details. That car is yada, 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 yada. He goes, oh, yeah, huh? I said, but I can't stand red. I hate red. And he looked at me and he's like, you hate red? I go, yeah. I don't like red. He says, why don't you like red? I said, because the first time I got arrested, I had a red lighter in my pocket. And the second time I got arrested, I had a red lighter in my pocket. While I was smoking my crack when I first got started, I like blue. I like clear, yellow. Any other color lighter but red. If you came into my abandominium or my abandoned car with a red lighter, I don't care how much crack or dope you had, you're getting out. Because sooner or later, I'm going to jail. Not you, me. I'm going to jail. So please, if you ever see me anywhere, don't flash a red lighter. I got over that. I got better with that. I had to work at that. You know, as you can see, I worked on it. You know, I don't mind the color red. The Japanese and Chinese see red as a sign of good luck. How is it good luck that every time I had a red light, I'm getting locked up? And my sponsor says to me, you sure it wasn't because you was coming from the projects or crack on you? I said, no, I had a red lighter on me. It's bad luck. He goes, you sure? Because I said, it wasn't because I was breaking into somebody's house. I wasn't damaging somebody's car for insurance claims. I wasn't doing this or something else that was criminal activity. It's because I had a red lighter. That red lighter is out to get me. I won't go to certain bodegas to buy a red lighter because dry lighters, because I know all they have is red lighters left because all the blue ones are gone. My thinking was deterred. My thinking was altered. My processing of life was wrong. I had to get that back right again. I had to change things. Everything. I used all over the state of New Jersey. It surprises a lot of people, even me, you know. I was in one courtroom. I got arrested by one county. I can't remember. And the guy says, what's your driver's license number? I said, I can't remember. The guy goes, look, Dad, come on. I know you know your driver's license. Just give it to me. So I gave it to him. And I'm still sitting in the cell. And he comes by and he goes, you owe me. I said, what are you talking about? Because you owe me. That's what I owe you. He goes, wait, put your driver's license number. And they just kept spitting out pages and pages and pages and pages of stuff on you. I said, well, he goes, yeah, but you've been all over the state of New Jersey. Committing crimes. Driving too fast. Driving out my license. Driving without proper inspection. Driving for Texas tax. All this. Why? I thought it was okay to do. My life slowly got better once I got on my knees the last 7 days of my active addiction, my active using, and prayed to the God of my understanding for help. On that seventh day, I got arrested. Of course, I didn't have a red lighter on me, but I was still pissed. They got like, I mean, how'd they catch me? What's going on here? You prayed to me. I answered you. And it happened. I said, I give up. I surrender. Whatever's going to happen, I'm willing to try. I got to try something different. 33 years of using has profited me nothing. Has gained me nothing. I don't own a house. I don't own a car. I don't own furniture. Just the clothes on my back, and half of them are still dirty. Never had a chance to wash. But yet I'm an educated man, right? I did go to college. I did graduate high school. I did graduate 8th grade. I even worked at AT&T as a junior engineer. I've worked at ExxonMobil as a tech. I'm a smart person. What am I doing with this kind of life? So, I had to work at it. I prayed. Got arrested. Went to jail. And I just kept saying to myself, whatever it's going to take, I need help. I said, I got to do something. My family doesn't even know who I am, where I'm at. My father remarried. I wasn't there for that. My sister, I got in glaucoma. I wasn't there to help her. My older brother was married. He lived in Georgia. My other older brother was married. He was living in northern New Jersey, too far away from Trenton where my sister's living. My younger brother is an over-the-road truck driver, making decent money, hauling all kinds of, I mean, stuff I've never seen before in my life. He couldn't be there for her. And neither could I. I was in jail. I opted out for a drug court. And of course you hear all this stuff. Oh, man, it's a setup. You don't want a drug court. You should go ahead, man. You a man. Go to prison. You're only going to be behind the wall 3 or 4 months. You got some time in now. You only got to be in there for 3 or 4 months. Come out to the camps before you know you're home on parole. As long as you don't get a hit. Well, what's a hit? You know, another charge. Well, you're talking to an addict that's got a mouth like a sailor slash truck driver. So the first person that gets agitate me, I'm going to cuss them out, get into a fight. That's going to be a charge. I'm going to send down a whole, all that stuff. I don't want that. I'm trying to do something different today. Something that's going to be beneficial. Something that's going to help me. That's not going to help me. I'll take my chances with drug court. And like most addicts, when they told me that I'm coming from North Jersey, 3 hours away down to Atlantic City. Oh, no, let me go to Secaucus. It's only an hour and a half away. Because I had reservations about still using. I had reservations about being too far away from my drugs. They finally saddled me up, put me in the back of the van, handcuffed me up, and drove me down Atlantic City 3 hours away. One of the things that I remember, and I told my sponsor about it, and I've told people at meetings in my area, that was a 3-hour ride. I fell asleep for a little bit of it, woke up. But when I got out of that van, those two sheriff officers told me, now this is November. This is in November. Usually it's kind of chilly and cold, maybe some snow on the ground. I got out of that van with the handcuffs and I turned around to face the building and the sun was so bright. It felt like it was at the top of the trees and I could feel it over my whole body. I told myself, this is where I start to make a change for myself. I got to learn as much as I can learn here like I did when I was in high school and college. I got to do what I need to do to save my own ass. That rehab was a good facility for me. I learned a lot. They had HMI services there, and I just kept progressing from there. I never will stop because my disease will never stop. And when I sat down after doing my four-step and listing all the good and bad things, you know, when you do a moral inventory, an inventory is a listing of things. A listing of things, whatever it is, that's indicative to what you're working with. If you're a truck driver, it's a manifest of what's in the truck, it's a list. If you're on a ship, it's a manifest of a list of things that you're carrying from this port to that port. If you open up your closet, it's how many shoes you got, how many pairs of jeans you got, blouses, whatever. It's a listing. So the inventory, you tell them, well, I got red, two of those, I got blue. That's how easy it is. That's how easy it is when you can sit down, get quiet, get the pen out, get the pad out, and write about yourself. Be honest. This is an honest program. When you get honest with yourself, things can flow. Talk to the God of your understanding. Ask your higher power for help. Start writing. Write as much as you can. You can never write too little. You can never write too much. But write. I did. And then when that's done, you want to move forward. Go over and see your sponsor. Talk to him. I'm ready. I'm ready to go over this. I want to find out. Like I did. I want to find out, man. I want to find out what's going on with me. Why I can't be successful. Not a success. Success is a one-time thing. It happens, it's done. You win a lottery, great. Thank you, goodbye, good night. But to be successful, it's an ongoing thing. Maybe it's this high you're successful. The next week it's this high. And you may be a little lower in the next success, but it's still success. You're never going to go below. As long as you keep working at it. But you only got today. This is how it starts. Today's the day of the beginning of the rest of your life. And tomorrow, if you should be gifted enough to be here for tomorrow, that's the first day of the greatest day of the rest of your life. And so forth and so on. That's how I look at my program. Every day I have an opportunity and a chance to defeat my disease just for today. I don't know about tomorrow, but I'm going to work on not, you know, succumbing to my active addiction again. And I need help. I learned I need help. I need all of you. Each and every one of you. Even if you don't know me, even if you forget about me, you just say, that guy was nuts. That's going to be some help. I know that this program works. When I went and asked my sponsor to sponsor me, he said, if you allow me to sponsor you, all right. And there's challenges along the way. I do the same challenges with my sponsors. I see how much they're willing to recover. I ask them to come to my house. I don't tell them how to get there. I tell them where I live. I'm sure they're going to come to my house. If they find a way there, I'll give them a ride home. If you want to go that far, then I'm willing to go just as far. I've had so much fun in this process. I've taken my sponsees, I've taken other people in the fellowship to see things like my parents did for me. You can do these things clean. I've gone to Pennsylvania, Charlottesville, Pennsylvania. Anybody know where that's at? Charlottesville, home of Roadside America. Been there. To my friends there. Went to the Statue of Liberty. Went to Liberty State Park in New Jersey. I've taken to zoos. You can do these things without smoking weed, without having crack, without having to hide in the bathroom with a needle in your arm for dope, to enjoy what your higher power has established for you to have. Every morning you wake up, do you have to go turn on the oxygen machine for the world to have oxygen? No, it's already provided for you. Go to your refrigerator for someone that's at home or like that. Open it up, there's food there. We have to go out and hunt for it. These things are being provided for us. This beauty all around us has been put here for us. Why do we want to destroy ourselves by killing ourselves through use of drugs, alcohol, pills, whatever else is out there, mushrooms, I don't know, tree bark, I don't know, elephant trunks, But it's what happens. This disease is insidious. It doesn't care. It wants you down. It wants to take you out. And it does it better than the FBI and the mafia could do combined. Doesn't need a weapon. It has you. And all it has to do is coerce you into doing what it wants you to do. And you're going to die. Unfortunately, in this program and in this process, you will have some friends and people close to you that will pass away. Almost a month ago now, I've had two close friends of mine pass away from the disease. They decided to go back out and use again. And it hurts. It hurts. To get that phone call and hear the person on the other side that found the body just crying and quivering and, you know, all of that, it just hurts. They had a chance. One of them had 7 years clean and decided to go back out behind a feeling. I've learned to get in touch with my feelings. I don't mind crying in front of you. I mean, none of you know me, but I would not mind crying to you. And now you saw I almost did when I talked about my younger brother. But I really love to try and help the next person get a day clean. I really love that. Whether it's my sponsor or not. I'm very animate about being in my home group, making sure I've got keys to make sure the door's open. I still make coffee. I still make the coffee. If no one else takes that commitment, I will be there. I sweep outside in front of the church. You need a ride home? I got you. Don't worry about it. Where you live? 2 towns over? Don't worry about it. I got you. I'll make it to work. It might be a little late, but I want to make sure you have an opportunity to fight your disease. I want you to have an opportunity to get some of the benefits I've gotten out of this program. The ability to wear red and not feel like I'm going to get arrested when I walk away from here. You know, this is so beautiful. This is so beautiful. I'm thanking each of you for coming out and listening to me share. I want to thank the fellowship here for allowing me to speak. I found out a couple of days ago, too, to come out. I did want to ask you to speak. And a good friend of mine, one of my brothers in the fellowship, said, "Well, hey, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm watching TV, one of my favorite programs, Ancient Aliens." And that's another story. We'll talk about it some other time. But he says, "Would you like to speak?" "Yeah, sure." I'm thinking locally. You know, one of the home groups in the fellowship area, you know, close to my area. "No, we're going to retreat. We're going to retreat. You want me to speak there?" Me? I only got 6 years clean. My mind's going through. Automatically, my disease is already starting to beat on me, right? You can't speak out there. You ain't got enough clean time. They don't know you, man. Who are you? Let's go get a beer. Nah, I ain't going for that. Not going for that. I'm very happy. One of the things I want to close with this. I don't mind telling people that I'm an addict. I don't mind. I don't care if you're an addict or not. If you're still an addict, I just hope that you come into the fellowship and get a sponsor, get a home group, and do some step work and help yourself to a healthy dose of recovery. At my job, I'm a forklift driver at a glass company factory. Not what I want to do. You know, I have all this knowledge and tools that do electronics and how to work on a car. Hey, I'm driving a forklift in a glass factory. Go figure. But I enjoy doing it. I don't like some of the people I have to work with, but, you know, hey, it's a job. I had a couple instances at this job. This guy cussed me out one time. Called me out there to go fight him. I'm not going to fight him. And, you know, first off, I'm battling inside this Marine attitude because it's still there. I've still got to work on this, you know what I'm saying? I'm still battling this guy. You know, I'm going to cut this guy down, chew him up, speed him out, you know, I rip up his head and, you know, urinate down his neck. That's not me. Come on. That's not me. Look at me. I'm 58 years old. I can barely get out of here. So I had this incident with this guy, and I backed away, and I backed away in the forklift. I'm looking at him, I'm like, "Nah, I'm not gonna feed into that." And I turned to my left, and my foreman was there, and I told my foreman, I said, "Did you hear what this guy's saying? You know, I ratted him out. Yeah, I snitched. Yeah. Yes, I did. I snitched." And I backed down and drove away. A few minutes later, called me to the office. So I go into the office. I had to explain my story to my supervisor, my foreman, and the foreman for this attempt agency for this kid. So at the end, I go out, right? And like after it's done, you know, they write it up and everything. I said, I got to go back to work because my, I don't know, it's a factory. Things keep moving. So I had to go back to work. So my supervisor's making this rendezvous, his walkthrough, and he stops me. He says, "Are you okay?" I said, "No, I'm not okay. What makes you think I'm okay? You and a bunch of other people can head down to Larry's bar and have a drink. I got to go home and have a bowl of cereal with 2% milk. I can't drink. I don't want to drink. I know what it's going to do. It's going to lead to a whole bunch of other things I don't want to be bothered with. I don't want to tear my life down. I'm dressed like this because I feel really good. I don't get an opportunity to dress this good. I'm not showing out in front of anybody, but I'm feeling really good today. So I put on some really good clothes. One of them happens to be that color that might have gotten me arrested back in the day. But I'm happy with myself. Every morning I wake up, it's a good day. I've never had a bad day in recovery. I've had bad moments in my day, but I've never had a bad day in recovery. Things may seem dismal. Things may seem like it's not going to work out. I've had more than one or two altercations with people verbally, and I've just had to back up on them, walk away. I'm not going to get involved. That's your shit that you want to bring to my table. I'm not getting down like that. I'm not going that way. Because I've learned to look at me. What are the triggers? What are the things that I've done that allow me to get negative with you? I don't need to do that. I don't have to do that. And then when I went to step 7 and 8, 6 and 7, excuse me, I go, "Oh, okay." And my sponsor and I said, "You know, you can't spot self-deception." "Oh, heck no." But it's a wonderful thing to know that I have an opportunity to work on these things, to get better with myself, to get better with the people around me, to get better with my relationships. Can't beat it. Thank you very much for letting me share.